Well, you may have all read this introduction. I'll just read what Amit came up with so nicely. In 1979, New York artist Jerry Wenstrom let go of his identity as an artist by intentionally destroying his large body of artworks and giving away his possessions. With this leap of faith, Jerry embarked on a journey which lasted well over a decade of wandering, listening, seeking, and relying on his intuition for guidance. Jerry is the author of The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey, and the subject of Parabola and Sentient Publications documentary videos In the Hands of Alchemy and Studio Dialogue. He lectures and offers film presentations internationally and has written monthly articles for Inferential Focus, a New York City think tank. Many of his articles are featured in Mythic Journeys magazine. Jerry's art is also featured in a film entitled Mythic Journeys. His unusual life story is currently being made into a feature film by award-winning Danish filmmaker Hans Fabian Vollenweber. And Jerry is an annual lecturer at Pacifica Graduate Institute. Now here at the what Amit wrote here, he adds this last little thing about a tower that you built, Jerry, on your Whidbey Island property in the state of Washington, and it's featured in a book called Holy Personal by Laura Chester, where 24 people talk about their handmade sanctuaries. And I know I'm going to want to hear a little bit about that, but I thought, first of all, maybe we should start by asking you to say a little bit about what you wrote about in The Inspired Heart, which kind of recounts such a dramatic part of your life. I think that book was published, there's a date of 1979 here. How does that...
Oh, that was the date I destroyed my work and gave everything I owned away.
Well,
the book is 2002.
Oh, my goodness. So there was like a 23-year hiatus between the book and the events that you write about there. Is that right?
Yes, I was approached by a publisher and asked if I would write a book. And
yeah.
And I said yes. I mean, I've had so many people coming here and asking about my story, and I was actually getting tired of my own story, so it was a great opportunity to just kind of download it and let it go.
Yeah, yeah. So here we are. We're going to ask you to tell some of it again. Are you going to be able to put up with that?
Of course.
Okay. Good. Well, I hope so. I mean, I must say, the stories that you tell in that book are just absolutely stunning. And I wonder if you would just maybe share one or two of those stories with us. I don't know if everyone on the call has read that book, which is quite extraordinary.
Sure. But you asked the essence of the book. Would you like me to say a little about that first?
Sure.
Well, I mean, you know, being asked to write a book, you could write about any part of any of us could write about any aspect of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, what is the most sort of sacred part, you know, the golden thread of life? And it has very little to do, in a sense, with what I thought I was doing, and everything to do with those moments that when all seemed lost and something magical happened that came through to save the moment, to save the day, and
yeah.
sometimes literally to save my life. So those are the stories, in essence.
Well, I mean, that's an extraordinary... that you've expressed it so clearly, I think, is fantastic. I mean, those moments. And... these stories all are accounts of such moments. You know, just as I was listening to everyone this morning, and I've written down a few questions, but I never quite know what's going to happen. And all of a sudden, I was remembering, thanks to what Audrey was sharing about her father's giving change to the homeless man, all of a sudden I realized, now I tend to do that. Anytime there's a homeless person or someone with a handout, I tend to hand over, give them some money. And I've long sort of understood that this is, to put it crassly, this is the one of the cheapest ways to get a beautiful moment from somebody. I mean, for a dollar or something, you have this moment of encounter with someone that's really, I find, quite amazing. And I thought, this is something that you, Jerry, are going to totally understand. Does this make sense to you?
Yes.
So, that was 1979 when you destroyed all your art.
Yes. So, do you want the stories now?
Sure. If you'll share a story or two, that would be great.
Yeah. Well, I thought I would start maybe with a story where, literally, the giving, I think, saved the day and possibly my life. And it was a moment when, you know, when I gave up everything, when I didn't have food, I fasted. When I did, I ate. And I was fasting for several days. And I went for it, because when you fast a lot, you tend not to sleep very much.
Hmm.
There's a different kind of energy that takes over. And late at night, I went for a walk. It was actually early morning hours. And I walked by the YMCA, and there was a gang sitting on the stoop out front, and I walked by. And when I did, one of the men came over and asked if I had a cigarette, and I said no. So I continued walking, and I was halfway down the block, and he calls me back. And it was one of those moments where, you know, is it fear or is it a moment of being fully present with what is and trusting the moment, which is absolutely what I had given my life to by giving everything up. I was going to trust what is without interference.
Hmm.
So on the strength of that, I turned and walked back. And when I did, he had a cigarette between his teeth, and he said, "Got a match?" And I said, "No, sorry." And I continued walking. And this time I was even further, and he calls me back again.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, there's that moment, and it was pretty scary.
I bet.
I mean, there was no one else on the street. It was very, very, you know, early morning hours.
Yeah.
So I walked back, and when I did, he said that the group got up and surrounded me, and there were some women that remained sitting on the stoop. And he said, "What do you have?" with all the men surrounding me. And so I used to carry, at the time in the neighborhood, these little boxes of, there was a Superman brand raisins, and the kids knew me, and they'd always come running when they saw me, and I'd give them raisins. So that was all I had, so I gave them each a box of raisins, and I put some down on the stoop in front of the women.
Wow.
And I continued walking, and as I was walking, I hear the raisins hit the street beside me. And the guy, now angry, says, "Get back here." So I turned and walked back, and the group was again surrounding me. And right in my face, he says, "Who do you think you are? What do you think you're doing giving me these raisins?" And it was an interesting moment, because I was able to, I grew up in a poor, mostly black neighborhood where we were the minority.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to access my love for young black men because, you know, in some way I grew up more black than white myself. I was easily able to access that heart connection. And coming from that place, it wasn't so much what I said as it was a place of surrender and you know, just feeling basically the love for, you know, even this
wow.
difficult moment. And I simply said I was just trying to be kind. And there was such surrender and, I think, feeling in it because I was there. I had nothing else but that feeling.
Yeah.
The women jumped up off the stoop and pushed the men away, and they said, "You be on your way now. They don't mean you no harm." And as I was walking away, I looked at the ringleader, and this sort of look of pain was on his face, like he was trying to impress the women, and they sort of defected and came over and saved me.
Wow.
So it was a moment where, you know, I think it had more to do with being with what was. I don't think of it as necessarily doing something good, but I love the I think it was the Bhagavad Gita, I found it. It's a quote I've used for years, that goodness is the final obstacle to God. And I think when we don't calculate our goodness, when it's just a moment's call, it has the magic and the potential that none of our strategies actually embody.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's just a stunning story. I mean, I find myself feeling how unlikely I would have been able to find such a place in myself at such a moment. But I guess one never knows.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I think is interesting, for some reason I think it's interesting, is that you grew up in New York, somewhere around there, right?
Yeah.
And how old were you when your life took you to the West Coast?
Well, I came here in 88. A group of nuns knew how I lived, and I had helped set up this art show. It was actually this amazing gallery set up was created by a Catholic Dominican nun and a Jewish artist, and it was an amazing gallery. Got New York Times coverage for its shows, and I had helped with this show, and I just helped, and I didn't, you know, they usually pay people. I refused the money, and that Christmas, the nuns came to me and gave me this little fish purse, and when I got home and opened it, it was full of money, and that's actually how I came to the West Coast.
Richard, there is just, sorry to interrupt, there's just a request from some people on the call.
Yes.
If you could speak up a little bit, I think they're having difficulty hearing.
Oh, well, very good. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Do you think it's interesting, Jerry, that you are on the West Coast now?
Well, you mean as an aspect of, I think it's, you know, it's where I live now. It's such an incredible conscious community. I'm on Whidbey Island, and I couldn't have chosen a better place. I mean, it's most of the community here that I'm involved with revolves, or had in the early days, revolved around what was the Chinook Learning Center. Now it's the Whidbey Institute. So it's an amazingly conscious community on all aspects. And it's interesting, you know, we have this house, this beautiful house that I live in that is all paid for. And, you know, and I had given up a 2,000 square foot loft early on. That's what I had in when I was painting. And the space that I have here downstairs was an old woodworking shop. And it's exactly the same size as the loft I gave up. So I feel, I don't know about West Coast, but I feel like it's an amazing gift to be here. And everything, you know, the sacrifice means to make sacred. And I don't think we should go around sacrificing things, you know, with the idea that it's going to be made sacred. But I think when we are called to let go of some identity or some smaller part of ourselves, when something larger is calling, and we can do that, it's sanctified and given back to us. Sacrifice means to make sacred.
Yes.
And so I feel like the West Coast and being here where I am, living with my beautiful wife after, you know, that was also part of my journey was, you know, 15 years of celibacy and being alone. And so I feel like it's all been sanctified and given back.
Well, it certainly sounds like that. I think behind my question was wondering if you felt there was a kind of cultural, any interesting cultural differences between, let's say, New York culture and, I'll just call it, West Coast culture.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, when I go back, I see how New York actually is now. you know, whereas before I was it, I think.
Yeah.
Well, there's a gentleness here. There's a softness. I remember first when I hit Seattle, I mean, even the bagman who came up and asked for money. I mean, I remember this bagman asking if I had money for, I think he said, alcohol and cigarettes. And I thought, God, he's so damn honest that I gave it to him. So there's something about the... I don't know. There's a gentleness here. There's space. You know, there's something. Everyone in, on the, I don't know, particularly in New York, there's this kind of scrappy nature that's just taken for granted. And it's like even the kindness has a scrappy edge to it very often.
In New York.
Everyone, it's like an attitude that it's intense and it's sort of working it all the time at many levels. And I don't know. Space, I think, is very important. You know, the space to feel a moment, you know, and to know how to act on it when there's a kind of almost constant pressure for action and, you know, and a kind of idea of what that action should look like in a certain way. I think that's a little heavier on the East Coast. But, you know, I don't know. I once read somewhere that the West Coast is more laid back because of the climate, because, you know, the people who were hunters and gatherers, they could easily eat by getting things off the beach and shellfish and whatever else. And so they didn't have to, you know, fight so much, and they just mm-hmm. They had more time, so they developed more a different kind of cultural presence than, you know, aspects of the country where they've had to struggle more to survive.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's apparent.
Yeah. Is Whidbey Island actually an island?
Yeah, it is. And yeah, it's next to Long Island. It's the longest island in the country.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the San Juan Islands or not?
It's not, no. It's south of the San Juans. But if you go up to the end of Whidbey Island, the San Juans are right there. You know, you can just get right into them.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking is I'm just wondering if by chance, I mean, we had a forest call with a man named Michael Stillwater a few weeks ago. Do you know of him?
Yeah, I do.
Do you happen to know the composer Morten Laridsen?
The name is familiar, but no, not personally.
Yeah. He lives on Waldron Island.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, that just thought I'd check that out. I thought it was very interesting. You mentioned in your book the one about the heart is at the age of 30, that 30 is an age, a crucial point in a person's life. And I was asking myself, well, how did that work for me? And actually, it was a crucial time for me. But were you around the age of 30 when you destroyed all your artwork? Was that how that
worked? I was 29, yeah. Well, you know, in astrology, there's something they call Saturn return. Mm-hmm. And that's the age it happens. And I can't tell you how many young people I have calling or coming here or emailing me who are in the place where everything is coming undone. And if you think about it, it's sort of the place where Christ did what he did. Buddha did what he did. There's something about that period in our lives. It's one of those transitional places where all of our willful, you know, the world is our oyster idea of who we think we are comes up for question. And there are two things we can do with it. We can ignore the deeper calling and just dig in and live our lives, you know, in some way miserably happy mm-hmm. on the surface.
mm-hmm.
Or we can give ourselves to that radical shift and let it take us where it needs to and come out of it more complete and have our dreams in some way intact, even though it inevitably looks and feels everything like death. And I think, you know, we don't necessarily learn much about that metaphoric death in our culture. You know, we think it's all supposed to be positive and love and light, when in fact, any journey worth its salt is going to take us into the depths where we're no longer in control. And to the ego, that looks and feels like death. And that's what that period was for me, and I think it is for many of us.
Oh, yes.
Wow. I just, when you said that, Jerry, I was just looking at this one thing from your book, which is, I just thought I'll share. You say here, we must be willing to die at any time, exactly where and when death occurs. We are free from the power of death when we make the fearless choice to trust and to experience everything in this experimental evolutionary process of embodied life. I think that's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the tower that you built, and that appears in this book, Holy Personal. Can you say anything about that project by Laura Chester and what that was about?
Yeah. Well, we have this cistern. It's funny, I'm looking out at the tower as we speak. It's right in front of me. We have this cistern that was about 10 feet high. That's our water storage. You know, we live in a rural area. And Marilyn always wanted a little meditation hut built on the top of it, you know, something that's up high. And she was inspired by Jung's, you know, Jung created a tower.
Yes.
And so, you know, I sort of thought about it. And I'm not a construction person. I mean, I never built anything. I never even built a wall for a house and didn't know how to do all that. But I would think about it, and I began gathering materials, and one day someone called me and gave me this wonderful, big, huge stack of, it was like 2-inch cedar siding, which is old growth, you know, real amazing old stuff that was going to be burned, and it was full of nails. And so we were working with this this Sufi group used to come out and use our space, and they called one day and they said, well, we're going to do this all-night work party, and it's a spiritual discipline, and we want a reverent project. Do you have anything we can do? So I had this group of Sufi practitioners pull all the nails out and clean the wood up for me. So it started sacred, I felt.
Wow.
And so that was a good beginning. And then I just felt the time was right to jump in without knowing what I was doing. And you know, everything went right. And there were moments when I thought, when I was ready to do something or I had already done something, and someone would just arrive and they would say, well, did you think about this? Because this will happen if you do this. And I said no. I would sometimes say no. And then the person would say, well, here's what you would do to fix that. But it was so amazingly magical. I think when we do something with reverence, with a reverent intent, whatever it is, I think the gods could jump in and meet us halfway. But this tower had that sort of magical thing. And whenever I needed something, I could almost always find it. Like when I was building it's got a very elaborate top knot. And if anyone wants to see the tower, there are pictures. I think it's in the sculpture section of our website, which is handsofalchemy.com. And so, like the decorative top knot, I wanted to put something on the top. It sort of looks like a stupa, Tibetan stupa. And I went to the island Recycle and found these bulbous Indian lamp parts, these great big bulbous parts, and I was able to put this very elaborate little top knot on it, peak on it. And then to top it off, when the tower was done, I was lying in the grass because I worked all summer. I mean, 15-hour days. My neighbors were laughing because they said, only you'd be out there at 3 o'clock in the morning running a power saw. Because I was just so jazzed, and you know, it was so, everything was falling into place. But when it was done, I was lying in the grass, and the phone rang. But first, I was lying in the grass, and I said, "It's done." I was just like so overjoyed because I didn't think I could pull it off.
Wow!
And the phone rang. I run in, and it was Laura Chester, the woman you mentioned from the book.
Gosh.
And she said, well, I'm from Maine on the East Coast, and I heard you built a tower, and we're doing a book on sacred spaces. And I said, how did you ever hear about it? But the moment it was done, so she came and photographed it and interviewed me and put it in her book. But then the final magical part, Marilyn, my wife, who I built it for as a wedding gift, I mean, it was a kind of gift to her. We got married when I was like 43, I think, and for the first time I got married. And Marilyn was doing Tibetan practice at the time, and she wanted to have the tower blessed somehow. So, you know, I was trying to think, well, how would we do this? It would be wonderful to, you know, of course you think the ultimate, I think, well, wouldn't it be great to have the Dalai Lama, but you know that's not going to happen. And our land is adjoined to the Whidbey Institute, the place I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And I go for walks there every day. It's all trail. There's 100 acres in trails. And I was coming up this knoll, and I see a soccer ball fly into these bushes, which were stinging nettles. And I see a monk going into the nettles with bare arms.
Wow.
And so I said, no, you know, don't go in there. I went in and got the ball and threw it up on the field for him. And when I walked up on the field, there were 9 Tibetan monks playing soccer.
Oh, my goodness.
So I thought, oh, well, maybe one of them would come and bless the tower. And only one of them could speak English. His name was Tenzin. They were the sweetest people. So I said, would you come and bless my tower? And so he talked to the monks, and they all gathered around. They were very interested. And they said, what is tower? They didn't know what a tower was. So I said, well, it's kind of like a stupa because it's 40 feet high. It's only 8 foot square, the little meditation place.
Wow.
But it's 40 feet high, and it looks like a church steeple with very decorative edges, and it's got lots of adornments. And so they said, what's a stupa? I mean, I said, a stupa. So they said, oh, stupa, stupa. And the head monk goes in and gets a book of stupas. And I says, well, it's not a stupa, but it looks like a stupa. And they say, which one? So I said, well, it doesn't really look like any of those. And I drew a picture because it has these jagged edges like waves almost coming down the four corners that go up the 40 feet that look sort of wave shape.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, or flames. It also looks like flames. Mm-hmm. He says, oh, flaming stupa. So the monks agreed to bless the tower, and we made arrangements the next day. And they came over, all 9 of them. So, again, this is an 8-foot square space, very tiny. 9 Tibetan monks. And I later found out they were all, they were actually lamas. And they got in and all, you know, crunched all in there with rice and water and chud drum. And they did this 45-minute blessing with chanting and rice and incense. And the film crew was here that was coming that day. And just, you know, while in the middle of this, the film, who was making the original documentary, Parabola documentary about my life, and so they filmed it, which people can also see on our website. You can see the monks blessing the tower. And then they went down into my studio, which is now full of a whole new body of artwork, these large interactive sculptures, and they played with everything, and I had built this marimba, and they were playing the marimba, and I had these old condom machines I found at the dump that I put runes in, you know, the Nordic runes, and they were getting runes and interpreting them. But they were the most delightful, magical people.
Wow. That's incredible. That is amazing. And now, did I understand you describing this tower that there's actually also your water supply in the tower? Is that or
underneath? Yeah, there's a. I had to build a trap door in the floor. The tower is very finished and carpeted, and it has heat and lights, and mm-hmm. and it's got a little altar. So the water is underneath in a cement square block of.
But it's actually know. is it enclosed by the tower? The water?
The water, you see, it has a 10-foot high cement base on it.
Yeah, and that's where
and
the water
it is underneath.
Water is?
Yeah, yeah, the where the water is.
So it's kind
of
like.
And then I built a stairway up 10 feet out of, you know, there's a technique called rammed earth where they do, they're also calling them earth ships, where they build houses out of tires and dirt and cement. Well, the stairway goes up 10 feet. It's a very elaborate stairway. It goes on and on. out of tires and cement. It's all recycled material.
Yeah.
I mean, I bought very little to build this thing.
I'm just sort of picturing it and imagining what a metaphorically powerful thing that is to have a house built on a water supply, or a tower built on top of a water supply.
Yeah, you know what else I did? Because the water trickles in a little hose, I hooked the hose up to, I like drilled up through everything, and there's a main altar in the tower, and there's a little Buddha sitting in this under a glass bubble, and in the bowl in front of him, the water comes up and trickles out and goes back down into the cistern, so that I feel like now all of our water is holy water because it runs through the altar.
That's so beautiful. Well, water is kind of a sacred substance anyway, don't you think?
I think it is, yeah. Especially this pure, beautiful water we have here. We have a well way down the hill.
I'm taking it that you probably are open to having visitors.
I have constant visitors. We have a dormitory. We have people stay.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a big part of my life is staying open to what comes, and many
That's
people
wonderful.
Come.
Maybe our conversation today will lead to some visits up your way. I certainly would love to visit.
Well, even the possibility of this interview has been bringing visitors.
That's great.
From your group. So you're a wonderful bunch of people. I love the people who have come.
Service base is an extraordinary thing, and I'm sure that it's very, very resonant with you. Here's a big, big general question. Well, let's just whittle it down a little bit to art. I was going to ask a question bigger than art, but what can art do? What are the important things that art can do? That's a big
It can
question.
Change the world like any other thing we put our heart and soul in. I mean, I think in the end, whatever we believe in, you know, and I think it's like almost anything. You know, there are few things that if we really ask deeper and deeper questions, it's going to take us to the place where we're no longer running the show. So I think what art can do is what any beautiful path can do that we set out on, is take us to the place where we have, you know, there's a wonderful saying, to set out on any holy purpose and to die along the way is to succeed. And that's not a literal death. That's a metaphoric death. And I think what art can do is it can bring us to that place, because we're always involved with inspiration. And inspiration requires sacrifice. It requires jumping into unknown territory and feeling like, you know, you may literally die here, and yet something, there's a kind of renewal and an inspired new level that comes into place. And I think art at its very best, believing in what we do, will do that with our lives. And I think the products of that journey are what we call inspired. I mean, we all feel deeply about a certain creation, about a painting or something that has been created from that space. And I think, you know, we don't even know why, but I think it's just the product that resonates with that transformational energy. And in some way, it beckons us forward. It calls to us to find it within ourselves. And ourselves, you know, being inspired by something is already to begin to feel that calling. We want something more than mediocrity, than just dead matter. Because, you know, I think my early life as a painter, it was all will, intelligence, and good intention, but, you know, and every once in a while, it's like Russian roulette. You hit the cylinder that, you know, blows inspiration through, but it was a hit-and-miss process. I think when we have given ourselves to that transformation, everything is transformed. I have a great saying stuck here on my bookcase, which I'm walking over to read, that says, "Die while alive and be completely dead, then do whatever you like, all is good." And I think it's that transformational quality of the journey of art or whatever we do, if we can take it to the place where that transformation happens, whatever we do after that, I think the end result will be beautiful and will touch the world.
Wow, that's quite wonderful. And you speak from experience, obviously. And changing the world, that is a huge phrase, but I like to think of it, I like to sort of look at it from this point of view, that to change something is changing the world. I mean, do you know what I'm saying? It's like to think of changing the world is like just a little overwhelming, but to realize that if I change something, that changes the world. I mean, if you look at it that way.
Yeah, and that can be positive or negative. I mean, a lot of us are changing. I think it starts with our world, our individual world. You know, our choices change the world. It creates a collective consciousness that has an impact. You know, whether it's, you know, voting in George Bush or voting in Barack Obama, or I think there's that level of it. But to change the world, it's all about changing our own world, because when we can take the risks within ourselves, when we can do it in the loneliness, the inevitable loneliness of our relationship with the mystery, when it happens there, it changes the world. And what we end up living out is the sort of consecutive line of inspirations that ultimately lead to these big sparks in life that make changes. And it's not a literal thing. If I do this, this, and this, I'll get this. Mm-hmm. It's more like you're living on the grindstone of your own inspiration, and you do what you do, you know, whether it's giving that the bag man the money in the cup, or, I mean, the many stories that are told, whether it's moments like that. But it's got to be all of life. We can't like say, well, I'm going to be a good little boy or girl right now and do this good thing, because, you know, again, goodness is the final obstacle to God. It has to be all of life. All of your life has to be tending the rightness of each moment. And when we do that, I think what comes out of it is a total inspired life. And that's our birthright. That's what we're here to do. And at any point, we can shut down and dig in and call ourselves a doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, and leave it at that. And there's our living death. You know, we might get all the money we want, or get all the, you know, the perfect little house and kids and cars and all the things we think we're supposed to have, but our total life is not that inspiration.
Yes, I mean, I think what you've described in the truest sense is the art of living.
Absolutely, and it's who we are, and to accept anything less, I think, is to sell our soul down the river, even if it's an artist. That's why I destroyed my art. It was too small a container. And again, it's sanctified and given back. I have another enormous body of work because it doesn't matter. It's not my identity. You know, it's not the thing I'm calling my false God anymore. Mm. It's all God.
Mm. Beautiful. Kanchan, are we about at the point where...
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. This conversation is fascinating, just to listen to Richard and Jerry talk. But I'm sure there are a lot of people on the call who also have questions for Jerry. So, and Richard, you're welcome to, you know, if we don't have many callers, you can also keep, you know, talking. But I just want to give everyone an opportunity to hit *6 if they have a question, and then they will be put in the queue, and I will unmute them. And it looks like there is already a caller.
Hi, Jerry. This is Audrey. My question was about just the different kind of stages in your life so far, and I was curious to know more about what called you to spend 15 or so years in solitude and practicing celibacy, and then how did you decide to then get married and begin making art again?
Well, it wasn't necessarily a discipline. You see, when I gave up everything, you know, again, I gave all my money away. I never asked anyone for anything, and I was completely present with whatever happened, unconditionally, which was terrifying at times. But part of that, living that way, and, you know, I lived my loft originally, which I eventually gave to a friend, and he started paying the rent, so I stayed there for several years. I mean, there were many alluring possibilities in terms of relationship. Across the hall from my studio was a yoga center, dance studio, and, you know, many attractive, beautiful people coming and going. And there was all of that. But part of listening deeply, it wasn't like celibacy, I'm going to be celibate and this is a discipline I'm doing. That was the old way of thinking, like I'm going to paint my life away, you know, or do whatever I thought I was doing. It was more like, what do I need to do? And I feel like those years of celibacy came out of being open to each moment, to each encounter with another human being, whether male or female, just being present. What is this about? And I always knew it, even though the nature of the ego and or what I thought I wanted, and the screaming body, you know, our bodies scream louder than what's real sometimes. That's why we get hurt in relationship, because we enter territory we have no business entering in a way that we have no business entering it. So simply by listening, that's what life became. I became those years of celibacy by way of listening, not by way of discipline. And I think the time just came where I went from that to just exploring the sexual energies with encounters, which was terrifying because finally, you know, I struggled with it for years. Finally, I said, well, what a good boy am I? I can do this celibacy thing. And then I feel like the gods upped the ante, and then it was like, okay, now it takes courage to walk back in, but not be sexual, but just be in the energy of sexuality, and where can that go? And I'm not talking morality, I'm talking energetic, like where can you go and make the room light up and not hurt anyone else or yourself, or not violate the moment is a better way to put it. So years of that kind of experimentation, and it finally brought me to Whidbey Island. And, you know, there were times when I had many people, many women in my life, I mean, who were very attractive, who, you know, when I came to Whidbey, I was like the new kid on the block, and, you know, it was like Hugh Hefner on steroids at some level in terms of the energetics and the attractions. And so what I did in being with the moment, it was like I knew where to go. I knew where I didn't go. And sometimes it was enormously difficult and scary, and I didn't know what to do. And what finally happened was, and this is very unromantic ending, I got to the place with Marilyn, who was in my life, my beautiful wife, and it got to the place where everything else fell away, all that intense relationship stuff that was coming my way started to, it all found its place because I did what I needed to do in the right way. And, you know, and I'm not saying the perfect way. I'm saying it all found its way with the best participation I could do, with being present and risking everything in each moment. And it finally settled into a place where I simply looked up one day and Marilyn and I were simply together. And it was so unromantic and so simple, but it took 44 years to get that simple.
Thank you.
So marriage arrived. I didn't. And for her, too, Marilyn was going through a painful divorce. That's how we met. I helped her work through that for a year. You know, we were friends, and, you know, and she was really suffering a lot. And so she didn't want relationship because she had been really badly burned. And I thought, well, this is my life, my celibacy, or, you know, the place I was experimenting and energetically. But so neither of us wanted anything. And I think one of the biggest obstacles to healthy relationship is feeling you need somebody too much, and neither of us needed each other, and so as a result we could have each other, you know.
Mm. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning, Jerry. This is Pallavi calling from San Jose. You know, I'm hearing a lot of whispers from you in this conversation, and my question is not specific, but I will allude to what I'm trying to get to, which is I wanted to know what your muse is to you. And I was particularly struck by the act of destruction. You know, a lot of artists, when they create something and they say, this is not me, it's my muse, right? And so there, probably my sense is there seems to be an attachment to the end product, which is the art. which whether you consider is you as in your identity or not you, that attachment is there. So what brought you to this place of destruction, and how have you changed in your, you know, your artistic, what is the word, right, your artistic sense? How have you changed in that since that moment of destruction?
Well, at some level, it has changed radically in that it was such an identity for me. It's like I said earlier, you know, I grew up poor in a mostly black neighborhood where we were the minority, had nothing going for me. Mm-hmm. The one thing I could always do, and, you know, do pretty well, certainly, you know, generally speaking, better than a lot of people, it became such an identity, because when you're so nothing and you have nothing and you look like nothing and you know, and the world sort of reflects that nothing back to you, you latch on to anything that looks like life or looks like, well, here I exist. You know, and I went, you know, I was acknowledged a lot for being a good artist, and I went to when I went to college, I was like their great white hope, and so this identity became, mm-hmm. you know, it was almost like I was running away from everything else, from my own being, because I didn't think I had a being. I thought my being was being an artist. So I think, you know, mm-hmm. I had to ultimately find out who was behind all that, and the only way to do it was to let go of the identity. So it wasn't so much an act of destruction, it was actually the higher calling of a creation. And after I fasted for a month at that time, and the only thing I did for a month was read A Course in Miracles, and they had just come out. The original way they came out was in Xerox form before they became such a popular series of books around. Mm-hmm. But I fasted, and I read A Course in Miracles, and for the first time in 15 years, I stopped painting for a month, and I was extremely driven. I had a huge body of work. I stopped painting, and I fasted. And at the end of that fast, I just got really clear that I could keep doing what I was doing as an artist, but it felt like a fear-based choice, or I could give myself to this exciting, abstract allurement that I felt like would give me everything, but it promised nothing, because it would mean becoming nothing and allowing it to enter. And it was just a very clear vision. So it wasn't not ultimately an act of destruction. It was a leap towards, it was a kind of quantum leap into something that I didn't yet know what it was. And all I can say, it was the most important thing I've ever done with my life. And I certainly don't recommend people destroying things. I think let your ego die. And whatever that death looks like, it's some, you know, it's never going to please everybody. In fact, it's probably going to please the people that matter the most in your life, because it's such a radical difference from who you thought and they think you are that you won't even have support. And therein lies the inherent loneliness that I spoke of earlier. To go your own way, which is the way of your own mystery, it's not even yours to claim, but to create a conversation and follow the journey of that mystery, you're alone in it. There's no one who can help you. I think a good teacher can point the way, but in the end, it's you and your God, and there's nothing in between. And that, you know, that's a sort of a two-edged sword. On one edge of the sword, it's, you know, it's a terrifying possibility. On the other is, our most unique possibilities come out of that. Because if it's all about you and your mystery, then that mystery is going to bring out your most unique qualities. What comes out is exactly who you are, and not any more ideas of yourself or other people's ideas of yourself. So what you enter is, there's no reference point. You can't say, well, I look like this or that, because it's not going to look like anything. It's going to be about being so completely who you are that what ultimately shines in the world is a unique expression.
Beautiful.
And we love that uniqueness, and we're terrified of it at the same time. We all want to look like something recognizable.
Hi, Jerry. A lot of people have already asked the questions I wanted to ask, but let me take this opportunity to thank you for speaking to those experiences of the death of the ego and the experiences of terror which can be very real in the hell we walk through to get to the other side. I don't think enough people really do talk about it, and so I find with myself but also with others, when they encounter those moments, they take it as a sign that they've done something wrong, and then they reverse course and try to go back to something that is easier or something that seems to work out with less Sturm und Drang. But I so appreciate your courage and for sharing those experiences so honestly with us.
Well, thank you. Sounds like you know the territory, or you wouldn't be able to recognize it in my story.
Hi. This is Gayatri. Jerry, thank you so much for your profoundly simple perspective on how you and Marilyn came together, and also your gift for her, the stupa, that was just beautiful, amazing. Yeah, my question was, you know, when you speak about this metaphorical death, what are the things that died for you, other than the ego? I don't know if there's anything else that dies other than the ego, or even if it dies, is it born again? That was my question. Thank you.
Well, I don't think the ego ever... I mean, the ego is harmless when it's taken off of its status as false god or god, you know. I think, you know, in a sense, the ego is the body, like it says in A Course in Miracles. You know, it's sort of like its physicality, it's the gratification of accomplishing things in the world. And I think what happens is it knows that it's dead after this transformation, and so, but it also, it's a part of who we are. You know, we're embodied beings on the planet, so what do you do with these bodies? I think when we can live out that mystery, the things that begin happening are so successful in ways that have nothing to do with our strategies and manipulations, and everything to do with surrender and reverent attention, that the sort of premise of those actions become successful at all levels, you know, not just in terms of the things we want in the world, but in terms of moving people, touching lives, being of ultimate service. Because we can't serve others if we have a place where we won't go. And that, you know, the quote that was said, that I said earlier by Kanchen about, you know, that the quote that she read, I think we have to and befriend our death, so that when we're confronted with it, we don't run for cover. In other words, someone comes screaming at us with their fear. You know, I don't mean literally screaming, but sometimes it can be that. People come at us with their projections of everything they're most afraid of, and we can, you know, by our ability to be fearless, we can transform that fear into a compassionate, loving action. And sometimes that action, it might even use the sword, or sometimes it might just be a hug, or sometimes it will look like nothing at all, but just staying present with the pain of another, and it'll transform them. And I don't care how good you think you are, how any of us think we are, or how much goodness we think we're doing, that goodness is limited by our proximity to death and our willingness to stand in the presence of our own worst fear. So the only liberation, the only true goodness on the planet is to confront your own fears and be fearless in the presence of the projections of others.
Thank you.
Hi, Jerry, this is Ella. Can everyone hear me?
Yes,
I hear you.
I'm not really sure what my question is. I have an idea, and I feel like you've answered it in parts. But, you know, I was struck by what a friend said earlier this week about in order to find lightness, he had to succumb to darkness. And it makes me also think of paraphrasing what you said, and hopefully I'm not misinterpreting it, but to live, you have to... sort of like to live, you have to experience death or let death happen. And originally I wanted to ask you, you know, because you said throughout this conversation that you have experienced fear. At times the fear has been very present. And so originally my question was, what do you practice in those moments of fear? What are your practices? But I guess in addition to that, I'm thinking a lot about living, succumbing to darkness, you know, in order to find that light. But is there a balance? Because I've seen people, and I'm currently seeing people that are really, in a way, physically and emotionally suffering by sacrificing everything, maybe living without any currency, living in a gift-based sort of economy, to a point where, you know, if they become physically ill, they can't afford, you know, health care. And so it's like literally experiencing a form of death. And it's like, well, is that just another challenge? And do you just, is there a balance? Or,
yeah,
I don't know if
that's your question is very good and I think very deep. You know, I think it's an important. And yes, there is. Again, I think when we can live, you know, as consciously as possible and be conscious of the fact that there's a knowing larger than our own and we're always listening for that knowing, it's almost like an embodied prayer. You know, our whole being becomes the question, becomes the questioner, becomes the prayer. What is this moment about? And it, you know, and I think we can do some pretty foolish things in the name of goodness. And yes, we can starve ourselves in uselessly, or we can create a lot of useless suffering. But I think in terms of, you know, a practice, I think it's that practice of reverence. It's that practice of embodying your prayer in everything you do. What if it all became a question of what is this moment about God? Not what is it about ego? What is it? What do I want out of it? What's the good thing to do here? What's the bad thing not to do? I mean, it's more about what is this moment about? What if we were to live with that kind of attention? I mean, maybe that's a practice. I don't know. But I think in the end, it's always, and this is what I said earlier about my book, it's the stories of these stories. It's like alchemy. You know, alchemy is about holding the opposites, good and bad. You know, all things opposite are held in a kind of conscious discomfort. The place of healing, the place of making the right choice, is trusting when we always do our best to meet our commitments, to be the best possible human being, all the things that we can do with our intelligence and will and good intention. You know, we have to do our very best. But they're never going to be good enough. And the place when we are most uncomfortable because we are no longer in control and nothing good works, words are not working, nothing is working, I think another discipline is to be able to hold the discomfort. And that's very alchemical, because in the place where we can hold the opposites and do nothing but just simply be in a state of reverent trust of the moment, that's the place where the quantum leap happens. That's the place where the miracle happens. And it's always the miracle that's going to ultimately save us. You know, not our, if I just become such a good person that, you know, all the world's going to come to me, because we don't know what's good. I mean, look how much the government does that thinks it's doing good and how horrible it turns out. Or even many of us, how often have we tried to do something good and it turned out bad? So ultimate goodness, ultimate action is always about that relationship with the mystery and surrendering into it. And a component of that is the ability to hold the discomfort. You know, you might be very angry at somebody because of their behavior and you think you shouldn't be doing that. What if you have anger and you have the desire to love. What if you just did nothing and held it like a prayer? Like, what is this moment about? What do I do with this? And you hold it. And so it's not about doing anything more. It's about holding the discomfort with the conscious intent of having it resolved by something larger than your own ability. And I think, you know, that's the essence of faith. Whatever your spiritual tradition, faith is the ability to hold that unknowing and trust that, you know, you're never going to be good enough, you're never going to be perfect enough, but that's okay. That's written in, you know. There's the Christ in the garden who has to have the burden taken away. We're all in that garden sometimes. Or the Buddha before enlightenment, you know. You know, if this thing can be taken away, let it be, you know. But I think it doesn't get taken away. We always end up a tree with no way down. But then, you know what, we didn't realize that we can fly. And I think the miracle is always that flight. So there's balance, and you have to do your best, but you also have to know it'll never be good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Jerry, this is Prakash. Richard and Jerry, what a beautiful symphony of the conversation. How are you, Jerry?
I'm good, thank you.
Thank you. You know, you gifted us so many precious gems. I don't know, I really take this moment to express my gratitude from all of us in this community. Thank you so much.
It's your community I've been tracking for a while, and it's a wonderful group. I'm happy, I'm honored to be a part of this conversation.
Thank you. I wanted to invite you to zoom in a little bit on, you know, many things that you said there deeply resonated, especially the idea around the conscious community and collective consciousness. I wanted to invite you to zoom in a little bit on your, you know, community, the conscious community, the way you would like to call it as. I wanted to try and understand, you know, how each one of us can be an instrument to manifest such communities in wherever we are, wherever we are rooted at this moment. And specifically, your experiences with your community, how did that come about, and what are some of the, you know, the important aspects that you have seen that makes any community a conscious community? Thank you.
That's an interesting question, because in some way, the idea of a community, I mean, and here's a bit of paradox. You know, I am a part of this community, and it was the most amazing place on the planet to be. On the other hand, I was never part of the community, and I never needed to be a part of it. I was just present with people and what was, and it's amazing what has come out of that. So I think it's almost like getting married, you know, the question about getting married, or, you know, so how do you bond with something other than your own little being? And I think it has to happen, or like me doing art again, it has to happen when it no longer matters. I think it has to be the end product of a lot of conscious acts of, you know, inspiration. When we are living our inspiration, we will be attracted to other people doing the same thing, a lot like the community you're already creating. I think if we go in thinking we need something or thinking we want to do something about, you know, the world in a particular way that has to do with our idea of what's good for the world, I think therein lies the failure. I've also seen in this community that I am a part of, I have seen a lot of people bounce off of it. I've seen a lot of really bad behavior. You know, I've seen people do really ugly things, certainly people in leadership positions. And, you know, and I think we've all seen some of these nightmares. So I believe it means people coming together in unknowing, not in knowing that what we're doing is so perfect and nice and good, but in unknowing, like here we are as a reverent whole talking to the same God. And the best way to talk to that same God is not to name the beast, but just to let it be its own entity. And I think the community that comes out of that reverent attention together as a group will create its own form. And it's like the individuality I spoke of earlier. That form will not look like anything recognizable. It'll be its own unique entity. And I think the more we try to pin it down or claim it or put it in our pocket and take it to the bank is the places it will fail. I think we have to remain present with each other and present with our best intention as a group, and what will come out of it will be as miraculous as anything possible.
Thank you. Richard?
Yes, well, what a extraordinary conversation, Jerry. Thank you so much for everything that you have shared with us. I just by chance, before our conversation this morning, I was reading an introduction to a book of Robert Hawes's essays that was given to me last night, and there was this little quote from Simone Weil, "Attention is prayer." I thought, wow, that is such an incredible thing. I'm going to have to bring it up in this conversation. Attention is prayer. What do you think of that? Do you know Simone Weil's work at all?
Is this Simone de Beauvoir of Sartre's?
No, her last name is spelled W-E-I-L.
Oh, no, I don't.
The person you would really love, this person. She's amazing. Attention. Something about our attention.
Yes. Well, you know, we can pay attention to our greed, too. I mean, I think I would just add reverent. You know, I think unknowing, conscious, reverent attention for some larger mystery is prayer. And I think I'm sure that's what she meant.
Yeah.
But I would certainly agree, you know, conscious attention. Because when you think about focus, when we're really focused on something, the most creative edge of that focus, we're really swimming in unknowing. We're asking, like, where is the next? What do I add to this moment? What do I add to this creation? What's here that I need to see that I'm not seeing? So we're already calling on something unmanifest, unknown. And so, in other words, even if we think we're how clever am I? I think in the heat of creation, there's always that swim in the mystery. And so, you know, there's the place of real questioning. It's not like, how can I get $1 million so I can do good in the world or so that I can buy a Cadillac? It's more like, you know, where in the heat of this creative moment is the next right move? Therein is the attention I think she's talking about.
Thank you so much.